All right, so today we have Peter Deswart joining us. Thank you very much for taking the time to discuss engineer growth and career pathing.
It's my pleasure. Anyway, I can help.
So let's kick right off with just talking about your own career history and career path.
I've had a varied history. Frankly, it's mostly pockmarked by a significant amount of luck. I started my engineering career back when I was in high school. I was lucky enough to live in Paris, France at the time. And we had broadband internet back then that was faster than the broadband internet I have today, living in California, which I always find slightly amusing. And that's where I got the bug, right? So if you have all this throughput, what are you going to do with it? Well, obviously, as a 16-year-old, the correct answer is video games. So I started playing Half-Life, and I soon realized that I was tired of playing on other people's servers. So I did a little bit of research, figured out how to build my own server. Once I had my own server, I figured I need to administer it. So that's sort of how I sunk my teeth into Linux, C, and some other scripting languages. And that's effectively where I also started getting my business chops, because some of my friends started saying, hey, I want access to your server. So I started building methodologies to basically sell them slots on my server that they could join anytime and it would automatically kick someone off. Everything has a purpose. Necessity is the mother of all invention, and that's definitely the direction I went.
Cool. So what kind of gigs did you have going out? You started off with building your own stuff and stuff. What did things look like when you started working for other people?
So interestingly enough, when I went to college, I was not sold on software engineering or engineering at all. I actually started as a biology major. And it was really just over time that I kept coming back to my desire to fix and automate things, which led me to my first gig. I actually worked for Cisco Systems in their supply chain department right after they had written off $2 billion worth of inventory back in 2002, 2003. After that major, the major collapse. And it was frankly at the behest of one of my advisors who said that our goal should all be to join the largest possible company and then slowly go to smaller and smaller companies while also getting bigger and bigger titles until you get the title that you want. And then from there, slowly go to bigger and bigger companies until you find that right sweet spot of the right title, the right level of responsibility and the right company size that gives you that sense of confidence and also of reward and engagement and ability to impact change on your surrounding. And that's kind of what I've done.
Great. So maybe talk us through some of that trajectory and perhaps like some of your big growing experiences as you went through those different roles.
So after Cisco, I actually went to a startup. I didn't entirely listen to the advice given to me. I went to a tiny little startup called Snowcap, which was the sort of version two of Napster, just as an average, individual contributing engineer with no special titles or anything else. And I, from there, the company kind of went sideways, which in a weird way was also a benefit to me because they really wanted to keep a very small subset of the engineering core. And I was part of that. So I had the ability to negotiate a little bit, and that's sort of how I started building out my first team at the ripe old age of 22 or 23. I can't exactly remember. And that led me to catch the eye of one of the executives that had left and who wanted to start a new company. So I was hired over to this new company. It was a small startup, never even got Series A, that was building Facebook applications back when Facebook applications were hot. So we did that for a while. Unfortunately, we also got stuck by the next major recession. Mm-hmm. That got me to work for a very, very small VC based in Southern California, which then led me to become, again, at the ripe old age of entirely too young, the CTO of a nutraceuticals company that was trying to take their product and effectively offer it online in a easy, automated fashion. There really wasn't much there. So I started looking around and I opted to go to Rubicon Project. And I think that really was the beginning point for a lot of my career progression. I sort of eschewed all titles and everything else and went to Rubicon Project as an individual contributor on the engineering team. And I was there for 9 years and I was lucky enough to basically, land a rocket, or at least maybe a pop rocket. When I joined, it was about 100 people. When I left, it was about 700. And throughout those 9 years, literally every year to year and a half, I got a new promotion. First it was team lead, then manager, then director, then senior director, then VP, then I can't remember after that. Actually, I don't know if I got a promotion after that one. And I just, you know, continued to take advantage of the different opportunities. And that led me then to take on a CTO role at IOTA, which was the most recent role before my current one. And in every single scenario, I didn't entirely know what was going to be required of me in my new role. But every single time I figured, you know, I might as well give it a shot. And I had enough mentors and support around me to do well, I would guess, given the fact that people keep offering me jobs.
Yeah, that's great. Wow, what a great arc. And in fact, it's been rare of the folks I've talked to so far in this series that they made such a growth in their trajectory at just a single company. So actually, I'm kind of interested in going back to that. You started out as an individual contributor, you said, at Rubicon, and jumped the ladder from engineering over to the management side. I kind of want to talk about that a little bit because, you know, as people always say, computers are really easy. They're very predictable. You do one thing, it's going to do the same thing over and over again, short of race conditions or whatever, right? But like computers are very predictable, people aren't. And that management side really requires you to gain a whole bunch of new skills for coming from engineering that are different. So I'm kind of curious how that journey went for you.
A lot of it, I think, also has to do with a little bit of my upbringing. Just, you know, I was a middle child. So my big sister is a brilliant woman and has a career arc that is well worth talking in and of itself. And a little brother who was the baby, I was always kind of stuck in the middle. And growing up, I got pretty good at sort of dealing with differences and expectations and cultures and approaches to things and acting a little bit as a mediator. And I think that's what helped me move onto the managerial side. And to be completely honest, I would consider myself a pretty good engineer. There are definitely engineers that are better than me. I am not the best engineer there is. And I found that I could help more people and create more value by thinking more about how the business and the engineering components of an organization fit together. So, you know, I don't really equate myself to an engineering manager in terms of sitting down with people on you know, a weekly basis and doing one-on-ones, which is one thing I do, but it's something I care about deeply. I think the real value comes in the fact that I've really focused on understanding what the business is and then help convert that and execute that on a daily basis within an engineering organization. And as a result, I've also had the opportunity to travel a lot. I spend a lot of time on airplanes going and talking to customers and explaining, you know, this is what the technology actually does, or alternatively, listening to them in terms of what they're trying to achieve and saying, oh, what you really want to do is do this. It's not really a product role. I think that a product role is often under-described as just gathering requirements. A good product manager, I think, takes a lot more into account, thinks about, frankly, an entire P&L, right? How are we going to take this to market? What's the price point? How are we going to sell it? How does this grow over time, et cetera? I was not doing that. And I think that's really what helped me move, you know, up the chain. My first promotion from individual contributor manager was really based on the fact that the team was growing a little bit and there was an open gap to just deal with team internals. And just like I like to automate, you know, tasks and everything else using software, I felt like the team wasn't being very effective. We just weren't keeping track of stuff. And I just looked at it like another engineering problem. If I do the following things, I can expect that the following outcomes will occur. And those outcomes are better than the ones we had. It was kind of automating the people around it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you took a sense of leadership in a problem and applied it, right?
Yeah, that's effectively it. It's one of those things where I don't have a lot of patience. I'm not an angry person, right? It's not like I sit there and, you know, get impatient, I start yelling at people, but I have this sense of this could be better and we can either sit around and wait or I can go do it. And let me be very clear. I have made plenty of mistakes. One of my favorite jokes is experience is that thing that you get right after you need it. And let me tell you, I've got a lot of experience.
That's a great way to put it. Excellent. So, going back to, you know, progressing through the ranks, when you went through these various levels and so forth, you said, yeah, I mean, it's more than just one-on-ones and stuff. And granted, in a bigger company, it's also about what they're going to afford you, both in terms of budget and time and consideration, and what your own managers afford you. But, you know, were you given the latitudes to delve deep enough into an individual and find out what makes them tick and where they want to be in a quarter and in a year and in 5 years, you know, what they want to be when they grow up, so to speak? You know, were you given those latitudes along the way to have a program like that?
Yeah, and it was frankly less of a thing that was given to me and more of a thing that was taken. The organization was growing. When I joined, there were, I think, 14 engineers. When I left, there were 250. So we went through a significant area of time of scale, and the HR team had to deal with the entire business. They weren't really thinking about engineers. And to be frank, though there are, you know, often some very, very competent ones, most of them don't think in terms of how does an engineer specifically grow. So I took the opportunity to look back at my career. What, you know, I've had some very good bosses, and I've also been lucky. I've had some really bad bosses. Mm-hmm. And I've tried to really stop and think about, you know, why was I angry at this person? What was the situation here that I found upsetting? What did I find was limiting? And I did my best to try and accumulate that into a series of notes and a series of structures that would allow the team to grow. And I think in return, allow me to grow as well. I got a really good piece of advice early on in my career, actually when I was still in school, from someone who was a longtime executive at Macromedia. And he said, your job at any point in time should be to try and replace yourself. Because if you cannot replace yourself, you cannot grow into the next role. Yeah, and I really took that to heart.
Yeah, absolutely. And I say that even like as a CTO in that role, because even from early stage, you're like, at least in my experience, I was doing R&D and, you know, hacking and that kind of thing. And yeah, you're absolutely constantly working yourself out of every role, even when you make that jump, when your org gets big enough to need to hire a VP of engineering, et cetera. It ends up that you might give half of your responsibilities to the next person every time, kind of like cell division or whatever. That's how I sort of thought of it too, you know.
That's a great way of putting it. Yeah, I totally agree with that. That makes a lot of sense. But so let's go with specifics, right? So when I joined Rubicon, there was one person that joined with me about the same time, but who had a lot less experience than I did. Like he was younger. I think this was his first or second company out of college. And I quickly developed a really good rapport with him. And as my career grew, I needed people who were going to help me do stuff. And so what I immediately did is I said, all right, I need you to start helping me with these things that are not core engineering, right? It's not writing code on a daily basis. And going back to my experience comment a little bit earlier, a lot of what I did, frankly, is, you know, once I kind of figured something out, I would actively remove myself and say, hey, I need you to figure this out too. But I do it in a way where I sort of set up some guardrails to make sure that, you know, he didn't go off what I considered at least the edge. And the premise, I actually used to joke about this. My goal is to throw people into the deep end of the pool. After I explain them how to swim, I will throw them into the deep end of the pool and I'll watch them kind of, you know, sputter about and try and keep their head above water. I'm always there sitting with a life jacket or whatever else is necessary to support them, but I kind of want to see them do it, right? You can't just talk to someone about contract negotiation. You gotta let them do it a couple of times to really get a sense of where to push and how. And that's just one of those examples that I used to use with these people. And that person who started as an individual contributor when I did, by the time I left, he had actually caught up to me in terms of growth and was one of my peers in the organization. And that to me is probably one of the more rewarding parts of that job, right? Seeing someone who has a tremendous amount of potential and helping them get the experience and putting them in difficult positions and seeing them grow and take on every consecutive opportunity in front of them was a really, really cool part of my job.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I have some similar stories with some of the earliest people that we had at VideoAmp when we first started. And these were the most junior of junior engineers, some of them. And they're still there. And in fact, what they've done in 5.5 years or so in their careers, just utterly amazing, because not only are they domain experts now, but they're tech leads in many cases. Mm-hmm. Or not only were some of them that didn't come in at the very beginning, but maybe a year or two in with maybe a comp sci degree straight out of UCLA or something like that. They're not even just tech leads. They're maybe directors of engineering. Now, it took us a while to get enough of an org size where there were other directors of engineering that could be their peers and mentors. But yeah, it's just amazing to see folks grow that rapidly, because it actually doesn't map to what many ladders require in terms of years of experience. This is a point of a lot of discussion with folks, because you get it both ways. You get kids that are straight out of coding school or whatever, and then suddenly on their CV, it's like senior engineer, but it's like, this is your first job ever, right? So can you be on the ladder really with that little career experience? Maybe, because there's the argument for merit, right? But mm-hmm. but at like 20 years in, yeah, definitely you should hopefully be senior something by then. But there's this squishy part in the middle where people get the titles of senior that don't act it. And then others who don't have the years in, but they're beyond their years, should have it or whatnot. So there's an interesting trade-off of time on task and so forth, for better or for worse in that regard.
But what I would argue against that, though, is I think people look too much at just sort of years of experience in coding and think about just the coding aspect of an engineer's job. What is often under-considered is the ability for that engineer to work within small team context, the ability to influence other engineers, to listen to other engineers, and to create a design architecture solution to whatever that is better than what was originally suggested, whether by themselves or by another. Mm-hmm. But it's also the business context. And it doesn't have to be specific to a vertical, but you don't have to understand. For me, you know, ad tech is unfortunately my life, and I will know ad tech for the rest of my life. But I also just have some core sort of business acumen that I've developed. And I think other engineers often underappreciate the value that can have on their career if they really do want to grow, even in an individual contributor role.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, so we've been through some good examples of your own personal growth. I guess what I'd like to talk about next is just some great examples in your own org and with people that you were managing. Like, let's talk about some of their growth experiences.
Sure. You know, obviously those range and vary in terms of the time I spent at different companies. I was just in a small company called IOTA. And IOTA had about 12 engineers when I started, and about 25 when I left. And one thing that I found really interesting is I had this one team of, we'll call them core engineers. They were focused on the runtime systems, very low latency, high throughput type system. And the engineering manager for that team when I arrived decided that, you know what, ad tech wasn't for him. And he was going to move on. And which I cannot fault him, right? Everybody, you know, has to work in an environment that they feel is rewarding, both, you know, in terms of the actual coding, but also in terms of, you know, what you're doing. And I was looking around the team, and this one person kept coming back as someone who was always answering my questions. He was relatively young, didn't have a whole lot of experience, but he was always there. And if I pushed back on him, the immediate answer was one of like, oh, that's interesting, let me go research more. There was never a defensive bone in his body. There was never a sense of like, this is, you know, this is the truth or whatever. And without wanting it, because he would tell me all the time he did not want this, he naturally sort of became the de facto leader of the group while we didn't have someone in that spot. During that period, I started to first to train him a little bit in terms of being a manager. And then I actually told him, I would like you to be the manager for this team until we can find someone else, which ended up being about 9 months, I think. And the result to me was amazing. This was a great example of an engineer who didn't like the idea of management. He didn't like the idea of doing one-on-ones. He didn't like the idea of having to worry about other people's compensation or anything like that. But he loved being able to help people. And so that's where I focused. Mm-hmm. If your idea is to, you know, support the business, but also support your peers, let me put you in a position where you can do that. I'll pull away the one part that makes you feel uncomfortable just to get you going. And I then tasked him with taking on more of the responsibilities in terms of team organization. Who works on what? What is a good design? How do you vet a good design? So one really good example of this was we had a very large inbound project to change the data storage underpinnings of the system. And he kept getting stuck between, you know, interacting with hiring and worrying about me lobbing questions over to him at random hours, and then dealing with the needs of the architecture and everything else. And I immediately sat him down and said, okay, so great. You have now learned the first lesson of being a manager, which is your time is no longer linear. you are effectively managing by interrupt. You're constantly going to have random inputs coming into you, and your goal is to clean that into a nice steady stream so that your engineers can be productive. They can take on a task, focus on it for 2, 4, 6, 8 hours, and then move on to the next thing. Your job, however, is context switching. So then let's talk about the effective way to context switch. There are a couple different theories. One theory is you batch. You dedicate 2 hours every morning to administrative tasks, reviewing resumes for interviewing, scheduling interviews, responding back to various questions that your dear fearless leader, myself, has randomly lobbed over to you, and just dealing with all of the other stuff. And then you establish a clear breakpoint, which you communicate to others. You're saying, I am not going to handle any of these for the next 6 hours, unless there is an absolute emergency, in which case, please use this one communication venue. And I'm going to go focus on the architecture. And he went from taking on this job and feeling a little bit uneasy to all of a sudden feeling pretty confident about what he was doing. He felt like he had that ability to help because he sort of figured out a way to divvy up his time. The next big thing was we ran into our first architectural disagreement, where two engineers effectively had two reasonable answers to a problem. And the only thing that would tell them apart effectively was time. We had to implement both and test them, which you and I both know is not going to happen. So we kind of have to pick, right? Sometimes you just have two good options and you got to pick whichever one makes the most amount of sense. And again, what I did there is, I know how to handle that. I have a couple different tricks. And what I try to do instead of handling it myself is I said, all right, we're going to all have a meeting, except that I am not going to interact as part of the meeting. I'm going to just interact with this with your lead, and I'm going to let the lead then interact with you. And it was a little bit of a contrived setup, but it did a couple different things. First, it allowed the lead to really take ownership and gain some good experience. But it also helped me show the rest of the team that I was not just willing to invest in the growth of the company, that I was willing to invest in the growth of individuals, because I felt like the payback on that investment was going to be tenfold, right?
If you
teach a man to fish, we all know the old maxim.
Yeah, the multiplier, the so-called multiplier effect, right?
Exactly. And so we sat down for this first meeting, and immediately everybody was like, my idea is the best and your idea is terrible. So I said, okay, so how would you make sure that each team member understands the other team member's point versus just sitting on their side of the fence and lobbing shots over? And I sort of let him kind of go a couple times, and I sort of slowly directed it in somewhat of Socratic methods, saying, all right, I want each person to fully relate the other person's position, right? And basically, force them to put themselves in the person's shoes to get a good sense of what was going on. That happened. That helped unblock things a little bit. And then we went through some of the more pragmatic talks around risk, right? So one version is more risky, but there's a higher reward. One version is less risky with a lower reward. Is there a way to potentially make them a sequence where you do the first one first and then you come back to the second one later because it's an incremental step? We sort of went through all the permutations. Then we reached the natural point where there's always one or two outstanding people who don't want to join the band. And at that point, I actually pulled the team member, the team lead aside, and I said, look, you've reached a very common point where you have differing opinions. That's fine. It happens. You actually want people to disagree, and you want people to disagree productively. But at the end of the day, the team has to move forward together, right? I sort of kept making this point over and over to him. And eventually he got to the point where he's like, look, what I need to do is I need to say that I can't always make everybody happy, right? We can't always do whatever everything wants. We have to do what's right for the business. And so I am going to take responsibility. I am going to make a decision. And what I want from everybody on this team is to acknowledge the decision that's being made, acknowledge that it may not be their particular decision, but also acknowledge that the decision is being done with everybody's best interest in heart, or everybody's best interest in mind. And he was able to do that. He was able to really take into account, he watched these two people bitter, which he had done before as a participant, and now watching from a Ruru's standpoint really gave him some context. And then he sort of saw from my vantage point how to handle that. And the outcome was actually pretty good. This was one of those slightly odd scenarios where the team members were like, yeah, I'm totally down, I'm willing to do this, I'm willing to stand behind this, I understand who's taking responsibility for this decision. It was a very clear part of that process. and the team moved forward. And there was never any talk later on of like, well, you know, we did it my way or any of that. Like, people really sort of got the point.
You're absolutely right. Couple quick thoughts there that came to mind. You know, you mentioned earlier with this lead taking on new responsibilities, it was a new kind of time management, because I kind of would equate it in a geeky way to like going from a concurrent model to a parallel type of model. And like you mentioned, you know, go off the grid for a while to do your things. And I've had this similar type of coaching with people where I tell them to just block out your calendar, like with discipline of what you're doing at different times of the day and week. And then nobody else can book you then, for one. And for two, if you're disciplined, you go by what it says. So if you're doing hiring or, you know, planning, architecture, whatever it is during those time frames, actually do that. And if you skip it, reschedule, like make sure in a time slice of a weekly basis that you're not missing. The other important point there, you know, concurrency is single threaded event loop or whatever. You're like, basically you can really just as an IC kind of work in a concurrent way. Once you get to parallelism, you're talking about many different individuals working together, and then the inter communication between threads or processes, however you want to look at it, is much more important. And that's maybe a bridge of thinking for people who have an engineering or a geeky mind to get to how to apply that to the people side of things. And I've always thought of it that way when you make that jump from an IC to sort of a managerial type focus.
It's really well put. Thread management is exactly it. And then you could actually equate sort of larger teams when you start managing multiple teams with multiple managers and everything else. At that point, you're managing discrete interacting systems that each have their own, that each have maintain their own state. And maintaining sort of congruence between those states can be entertaining.
Absolutely. And then I haven't been in orgs big enough. I've always mostly been in smaller companies under like 250 people, but I guess I could imagine that in even bigger companies, it becomes a lot like large scale distributed systems where message passing and queues but I guess I'm getting a little off the rails here with the analogy, but,
I think that works pretty well. I think that works pretty well.
So any other success stories or folks that maybe amazed you just in terms of their uptake or their trajectory in your time working with them?
Yeah, the one thing that I always feel as engineers we don't talk enough about is the IC rep, right? Because it doesn't sound as cool. I've had a lot of different situations where I had great engineers and who literally felt like they wanted to become a manager for a couple different reasons. One, they wanted control over the architecture, the process, because they felt literally like if I'm given the leeway to do this, I know I can put something really good together, but I just need a little bit more leverage. I need a little bit more authority and responsibility to get it done. And the second thing is, you know, I want more money. I'm contributing more to the organization and I want to be rewarded as a result. So that is something that we love to talk about, but I don't think as engineering managers, we always necessarily do a good job. And I got lucky early on where I had one guy on my team who epitomized everything that is great about architects and also epitomized the fact that he would be a terrible manager. That's one of the first things I did when my team was growing at Rubicon. I reached that first point where I went from being a manager to being a manager of managers. And I very quickly realized that being a manager of managers is very, very different from being a, you know, sort of a first level manager. And I decided, you know, we have to be able to have a consistent way to talk about all these different roles across the engineering organization. So I put together this entire, it still exists today, this wiki document that has all of the different steps. So there were four different levels of, you know, sort of standard, you know, software engineer. And then there was a very specific fork in the road where you can go either the architect, principal architect, et cetera, or the manager. I tried to work with HR because what I wanted was for people that went from software engineer to manager had to take a pay cut instead of a pay raise. Just as like a way to prove that they were doing it for the right reasons. Never happened. It was one of those great in theory ideas. But the architect one, I spent a lot of time focusing on, and I forced it to have equivalent managerial steps, or equivalent steps to the managerial end. There were four different positions on the manager side, there were four different IC levels that were equivalent. And the main difference was the management of people and projects versus the management of a vision or an architecture. And so we had this one guy who was perfectly suited to go up this track. And the hardest part really was making sure that the rest of the organization recognized that he was the person who was responsible for the architecture. I would take care of a lot of the business ended meetings, but as soon as we went into sort of the big architecture stuff, I was like, he may, technically report to me, but in terms of responsibility, he is above me. And so we are going to do what he says. He is going to manage the process of defining the architecture. I'll help manage the people and the feelings and the emotions. But this is his responsibility and he will be held accountable for it. And so by setting up these things, it really did like enforce it, not just for that person, but also for the rest of the organization, that this was a legitimate track. I got lucky. I had a good person that I could push up that track who did the track justice. And that really helps make the rest of the organization recognize the value of it. And that's hard to have.
It sounds like from what I'm hearing, you wrote the path for this organization. They didn't have one before that.
No, there was nothing. When I joined, there was job descriptions were tough to come by.
I went through similar exercises as well, and things became a lot easier once it was written down. I mean, there's actually some really good published ladders out there, and I have to admit, when I needed to do this, I didn't totally cargo cult it, but I modified it for our uses and so forth, but it became really good for managing the one-on-ones and stuff, and to place people on there. It's like, you are here, right? And then especially in one-on-ones and development sessions with each IC, it's like, well, where do you want to be? I guess I used to consider myself in that quantum superposition of both sides of the ladder, just because there's some of this and some of that, but that changed, right? I had to basically use discipline and put myself squarely in one part of it. But nonetheless, it's all about knowing where you stand and how to get to the next place, wherever that is, and what do I need to do to get there. And in a lot of the talent I used to interview and stuff coming from other companies, you ask like, why are you in market? And they come from a team where that's not taken care of and it's very ambiguous. Yeah. And it's like, I don't know what I need to do to get to the next place. Yeah. And maybe I'm paid well too. It's not all about just money. It's like, I want to know what I need to do to get to the next title. And I don't know. I've always been like, titles don't matter. Flat organization. Well, it does matter, actually. It matters to most people. And it matters, when they write their own history and how it's going to look on their CV when they go to the next thing and the next thing. Because frankly, nobody ever works together forever in a career. You're actually an outlier, I would say, having been at Rubicon so long, because a lot of people I've looked at, maybe 2 to 4 years is a long time. 4 years is a long time sometimes at a place, you know.
I got lucky. There is no doubt. I just want to touch on one of the things you just said, which I think is important, is you recognize the value and importance of an individual. And I don't think people necessarily think as much about every individual is effectively their own little company, right? And they need to think in terms of what's best for them. And I feel like a lot of the times companies, the normal sense of a company, right, an organization with lots of people, don't take that into account as much. And don't think about, there are small investments I could make, which don't cost me a lot, but create a lot of value for this person and for their long-term trajectory. And if I do that right, one of two things will happen. They will either grow within my organization and contribute more and more value, or alternatively, they get to a point where they outgrow this organization, they need to go do something else. But I would have that person out in the wild as an ambassador to what is being built within these four walls.
Yep.
Because I've had this happen more than once, where someone talked to the person who had left Rubicon and said, I heard from my buddy who worked here that he loved it and he just outgrew it. I mean, that sounds like a great problem to have. Like, I'd love to work here because I feel like you are going to help me grow during whatever phase of my career this is, 2 years, 4 years, 12 years, whatever. And I'm going to get a whole lot out of it, than a whole lot more than just a paycheck. Right. And that to me is thinking a little bit more long term about the health of an organization.
Absolutely. And that takes a page straight out of, I don't know if you've ever read the Netflix Cultural Manifesto, that they published a long time ago, we derived a lot of ours from that early on. And one of the cool things in there that shocks some people is they say, we want you to be successful in your career. And if you find yourself stuck and you can't move up here because we don't have a role for you, we're going to, throw you a pizza party and give you high fives on the way out and wish you the best and maybe even leave the door open for you to come back someday. So that's kind of along those same lines. It's like you treat people good, even when you don't have a place for them and you don't look at their separation as a bad thing per se.
I have not read that manifesto, which is somewhat embarrassing because I feel like I should have. This is a big one and I'm totally going to go read that now.
Yeah, it's good stuff. They revised it too. But there's some pretty hardcore thoughts in there because I mean, they pay people way above market. They also expect a lot. And I think that some of the things in there, if I'm not misquoting, they were just really quick to fire too, or like they're quick to decide when it wasn't working out. So I think there's a lot of people who gripe that worked there, but they just require really, really, really high performing individuals because it's a tough job, and it shakes a lot of people out pretty much.
Yeah. I've heard similar outcomes, but you also can't, you can't question the output that they've had in terms of the open source community, the quality of engineers, the product itself. It is approach. I would say one thing though, I think that what you did is the right thing, which is you took that, you did your research, right? You took that as a foundation, but then you adapted it to your own. And too often, I know we all see this where someone says, we're going to take exactly this as is. And because it doesn't jive exactly with their sort of inner culture direction, it ends up not ringing true and actually being worse.
I've seen people, you're absolutely right. I've seen this apply a lot lately to people applying the Spotify model. They have guilds and there's all these different names for the types of organization and the fact that anybody can edit any repo and there's a whole thing to the way they scaled. And there's actually a lot of good articles on how people tried to apply it and it failed for them because they, cargo culted it or whatever. They tried to just copy paste it and it didn't work. I will say when we were doing our cultural architecture early on with the VideoAmp, we are spending a ridiculous amount of time with say a core executive team of 3 to 6 or whatever. We were investing probably 1,000 person hours a year or whatever in this. So it's early stage startup, right? We're working easily a 12 to 15 hour day. I'm not joking. We might pull a 15 and then spend 3 more on a cultural session from 6 to 9 PM or whatever. And it's just, at the time it was literally mind boggling. But it was that important to us too. And in effect, we inverted that sometimes, or we do offsites or whatever, just to be fresher at it because you're not as good after 15 hours. You're not even all right to drive in some cases,
Culture drives so much of it. And it's weird because as engineers, right, we think more in terms of binary ones and zeros, this very specific deterministic outcomes. And yet really having that down, you can do some really cool stuff if you put together a good organization that works together.
Absolutely.
And I feel like a lot of the ones that have worked, frankly, to me, in hindsight, it kind of looks like luck, right? The right people show up at the right time and ask the right questions, and they just kind of follow their instincts. I haven't seen a recipe that allows repeated success yet.
I would say one of the other benefits of that exercise was that it took me a while to crystallize what my own purpose was in what I was doing and in general. And I came to a purpose that I tell other CTOs and et cetera, especially when we've just met and maybe we're having a beer or something and to get to know people. And what I say is, my goal is to build environments where people have the chance to do the best work of their lives, be challenged outside of their comfort zone, have magnitude level growth, and be worth more in the marketplace during and after their time with the company. And it's not just lip service. For me, coming up, most of my career is an IC and an engineer through all the different levels and, just being still a hacker. I still hack all kinds of fun stuff all the time. I can't help it. I've slowed down a little bit because of eyes and wrists and things, that wear out. And I need reader glasses now, which is a really hard thing to take. I don't always need them, but if I'm got too much screen time, it's just, oh man. But I can't stop tinkering and hacking. And to me, it's a way to really relate to people in my teams and whoever I work with and even doing a lot of R&D and handing over to other people. Because like I think you said earlier that you're not necessarily the best programmer. Actually, correct me if I'm wrong. Did you say that you're not necessarily the best programmer, but you want to hire people that are doing that?
Oh, yeah. I am not the best programmer.
Me neither. I have, you know, I'm probably the most mediocre at everything I do. Maybe the breadth is there, but I've really enjoyed working with people who are way better at all those other things. And that actually warms my heart, you know, to see the people making these outsized growth and stuff. And not everybody does, by the way. Frankly, there's a fair amount of people that just show up for a paycheck. And then, unfortunately, there's even a detrimental small cohort of people that fester. And, you know, I mean, it just happens in any org when you grow. And people change, too, you know. It could be awesome for a while, and maybe stuff happens. Life happens, even, you know. And sometimes, especially if you're not one-on-one enough with the team, you don't give people the opportunity to tell you what's going on with them. And, you know, I found a cadence of around 2 weeks is kind of a minimum. And so even scaling, in fact, that's kind of what I wanted to talk about next, is just how do you scale this when your org is 5 people or 10 people, you have time to, you know, that end-to-end problem isn't an issue, but you know, how do you build bigger teams and keep that mojo alive as it gets bigger?
That's a hard one. That's a really good question. One that I've sort of fought with various different iterations. So I totally agree with you. I think one-on-ones are critical. One-on-ones don't have to be long. They can be 15 minutes grabbing coffee. One thing that, frankly, and this really bugs me, is when people said, oh, I had a one-on-one with so-and-so, you know, their project is going great. And I said, and I would always ask, well, but how are they doing? Like, what's going on with them? And they're like, well, I don't know. We just kind of talked about the project. And that's the thing that gets missed, right? The one-on-one should be mostly about the
individual.
The individual reporting back, you know, what are their concerns? What are their strengths? What's going on that may impede their ability to be successful because they have outside influence, right? They have, they have issues with their housing situation because they have to move, or, you know, something's, you know, they keep getting sick. Like, there's a lot of different things that go into this. And I don't feel like people really pull that in enough. But then once you move, sorry, you want to ask a question there?
Well, I was just going to say, yeah, and there's a benefit to having a normal cadence. Like, it's very important not to reschedule or bump. And the fact that an individual knows that they have your time, they'll preempt a little bit. If it's not totally important, they know they can vent or discuss anything. If you get a good enough rapport with folks, they'll tell you pretty much everything if you do this enough and open up and be vulnerable yourself. I always talk about my own growth and failures with people, and that usually helps a lot. And yeah, it's like with the regular cadence and a certain kind of format, it's like they would, yeah, they don't need much coaching after you've done this for a quarter or two. It's like pretty much that. I would jokingly call it being an armchair psychologist and a camp counselor all in one. You know? But yep, it's super important. Let's say you do that and then you stop doing it, maybe because you've given someone a new manager, you're scaling the org, and now that doesn't happen. And it, mm-hmm. you know, you can't. It, you know, that which is observed is respected. So it's up. I felt it was on me to make sure that my next level of management was still doing it the same cadence and all of that. And after a while, you just can't know if it's still going on. Well, you can skip level one-on-ones are important too. But yeah, that was just the point I wanted to make, is that it helps people ride through tough times knowing that at least have a one-on-one coming up soon. And maybe if they take good notes or whatever, some people would, they keep a black book and they write their thoughts down for their next one-on-one. They'd be able to hold it until then, et cetera. You know.
So, but I think you said one thing that I always take issue with, which is I find that managers will reschedule their one-on-ones for other things first, right? If they need a block of time, the first thing they'll do is go find one-on-one time and move that. And
that's the worst thing you can do, in my opinion, but go ahead.
No, it sends a really bad signal, right? So whenever I have first-time managers, the first thing I tell them is you need to create a one-on-one schedule, spread it out, but also make sure that there are solid blocks, right? Don't have 30 minutes here, then a 30-minute break, then 30 minutes there, like, because that time is just ripe for getting overridden. Do a block of, like, you know, 2 people, 30 minutes together, back-to-back, right? That's a nice hour block that is just off the books. And then if you do need to reschedule something, if someone's really pushing hard to reschedule, say, all right, is this project more important than the other project that we have a check-in for? Because if that's the case, I'm going to reschedule that project. I'm not going to reschedule the one-on-ones. And if you do that, I feel like it reinforces that the engineers have, like, they're important.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And
they're time valuable.
Absolutely. And besides that, it communicates, there's a saying, right? Like how you do one thing is how you do everything. And it communicates not only are they important, but like if you're erratic and flaky and all this, it probably spreads through your whole day and your whole being and maybe even your whole org if you're overseeing an org. And actually, it even begins before someone's hired with just the candidate experience. And we're going to jump to wildcard questions at the end here about that. I don't want to spoil the fun, but I've noticed it both in how I assess talent, how I assess maybe vendors. Like, you know, as you know, when you're heading up technology, you get just blasted out every day from recruiters that want your business or vendors, whatever it is. So yeah, I mean, it sends a really poor signal that you have bad time management skills, along with other things. You know, not to get into effective meeting management skills, but it's like be the hell on time too. That's the other really small stickler I've got with people and
that
whole thing, you know. It's just like don't ever show up late. You know, it's kind of bad as a leader to throw out the my time is better than or more valuable than yours, even though it is. But it's like every minute you're late to this meeting, 10 other people in this room are wasting their time. So time is super important.
But the knock-on impacts, right? That means that someone stopped their work and is going to have 15 minutes of contact session on their end, but that's going to push back another meeting. Like the ripple effect is just huge, terrible. And so you mentioned one other thing, which I think also gets underappreciated and also not necessarily executed properly, is skip level one-on-ones. And as you move from a manager to a second level manager, or you have brand new managers, the value of skip level is often undervalued. So doing skip levels allows you to get a sense of like what your manager is doing, right? It's a feedback loop for them, but it also helps you give another vantage point to either the ICs or the first level managers or whomever you're working with that gives them a second source of feedback. And you shouldn't obviously run it, you know, weekly or biweekly, right? This is something you do maybe monthly, quarterly, or ad hoc. But having those really gives you as you move up the management chain, a better sense of what's actually going on in your organization, right?
Yep.
Last thing you want is a bunch of people working for you to tell you that, you know, your clothes are beautiful when you're not wearing any.
Yeah.
And the other thing it does is your job may change. You may go somewhere else where you're managing 100 people to then managing 10, right? You got to keep those skills warm.
That's true.
That's valuable too.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to say, two points. I brought up a big thread on this 3 or 4 years back in the LACTO forum. And you know, I thought, you know, I'm going to share this epiphany with people who probably already agree or know about this, you know, like how important it was for me and what the effects were and all that. And I was expecting to just get applause from everybody. And I got a lot of, from people and stuff, but I had a couple of people adamantly push back. And I was like, how can that be? And they're like, well, that means you don't trust your management chain if you're doing that. And it sends the wrong signal and all that. And I'm like, no, it's living what is an open door policy. If you say you have an open door policy, surely everybody can come in and talk to you at any time. Most people never take advantage of that, even if your door's open and you reiterate it all the time. But it really does enforce the quality control because the buck still really does stop with you and your org, especially as a CTO. That's thing one. Thing two is it avoids surprises. I really don't like surprises, and they can be of many flavors. Like by the time an individual is leaving your org, like nobody should be surprised. They shouldn't be surprised if it was for poor performance, because ideally you're pipping them and you're giving them chances, or maybe it's so egregious they should know that what they're doing is going to get them fired, right? But also, you know, that person that may be getting let go could be the middle management that you're skipping over. So you're giving a feedback loop and you're giving an outlet to people who may have issues with their management, and who do they go to otherwise? And they may feel intimidated or feel that there's retribution involved if they go to you. So you have to constantly remind people, you can always talk to me. My door is open. This is a cone of silence here. You're not going to, you know, you can basically say anything you want here. It's not going to be used against you. And even though I used to tell people that all the time, I felt like I had to reinforce it all the time. And skip levels, 1,000%. And there was just a few people in the CTO community that just wouldn't agree with me on that. And we had to leave it at that, you know, I couldn't believe it.
The trust argument though really bugs me, because the way I interpret that is that it means one of a few things, right? If you feel like it is a violation of trust, does that mean that you're not actually sharing information properly, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I've done this before, and I will say, hey, you know, by the way, you know, Bob, I'm going to go meet with your, I'm going to go meet with Alice, who works for you. You know, first of all, I'm going into this. Is there anything I should know to make sure that I'm properly prepared? You know, try and gather a little bit of feedback there. I'll go talk to Alice and I'll say, look, Alice, I'm, you know, obviously we're talking within the context of this. You know, I just want to make it clear, you know, Bob's still your manager. I'm just here to sort of help and get an extra sense both for myself, but also I want to hear from you in terms of what, you know, what you think you should be doing so I can get a different, you know, vantage point. You may say something to Bob that Bob sort of dismisses as just not particularly important or interesting because of his own context. That may actually be really interesting to me, or vice versa, right? And during that conversation, I will ask, you know, Alice, look, you've said these things. Is it okay if I go talk to Bob about this, or do you want to take this on your own? Because you can do that. I am more than happy to respect your confidentiality. Yep. And then I live up to that. But and then afterwards, I'll go talk to Bob. Hey, chatted with Alice, went great. You know, it's interesting. I heard this thing. What's up with that? And then sometimes you get some really good context of like, oh yeah, that thing. Well, actually, what's going on is this over here. So what you should really talk, you know, go over here and talk to Susan, or there's something else going on because there's a, we actually have a, we're understaffed, or we have a resource dependency issue. Like there's, you just get so much more information. So I do not buy the trust argument. The trust argument means that it's not with the one-on-one. The issue is frankly with you.
And yeah, I mean, I think you talked about mistakes and failure, and you know, that's the success of any good startup or growing startup or company in general, is that you iterate fast, you have an accelerated learning rate, you fail fast, you stop doing things that don't work, you multiply on the things that do, and you embrace failures and they're out in the open. So like I said earlier, I was usually the first one to expose my own failures and learnings, because nobody's born knowing this stuff. You have to constantly learn and grow and be transparent and so forth.
I just did a summit with my entire engineering team a couple of days ago, and one of my managing engineering managers, in the middle of the entire group, I said something, and he's like, no, that's wrong. And he proceeded to tell me very, very clearly why it was wrong. And I looked at him like, dude, thank you. That was really helpful. I didn't know that. Now I know, right? And this was not contrived or set up at all. Like, I literally thought something, it was just plain wrong. And I am forever indebted to him, because now he has shown that there is there's absolutely no penalty for you know, piping up and saying something, and B, that I'm fallible. Right? If I can get, I always tell people, if I can be right like 55 to 60% of the time, I am amazing. Probably not even going to reach that, right? Just bear with me, right? I'm going to make mistakes. And if I do, tell me.
Let's change gears. Let's go into the wild card session. I always love wild card questions, whether it's a discussion like this, and especially in interviews. I mean, a side story, I badly damaged my wrist and had to have it rebuilt a while back, about 3-4 years ago. And it was when I was at Video Amp, and I had to get it rebuilt, like had all these pins in there, and I had to wear a cast. And so for literally kind of like 2 years, I really couldn't type a lot. For sure, for like 1 year, I typed with one hand for a year. That's impressive. Siri and stuff like that. And so I was already pretty much running talent anyways, but until we really hired like an in-house chief of people and recruiters and things, I was running full process, literally first contact to offer. And of course they're interacting with plenty of people along the way, but I would always ask folks, well, I do two things. Number one, I'd ask them to talk about the coolest thing they've ever built. I want to hear from you. Even if you're introverted, you should be able to tell me that. But then also, you always hit folks with wild card questions, and it really like brightens the discussion. And it's really, that's how I learn stuff too. So in this kind of topic, I want to talk about candidate experiences. So whether on the applicant side of the table, or and/or from the hiring or the company side of the table, maybe if you have any like stories you can talk about, like the worst interview situations you've been in from either side of the table.
Yeah, I've got some horror stories. I got to protect the guilty here a little.
Everybody
bit.
Does. Yeah, you don't have to use any names or specifics.
From my end, it really is the golden rule, right? Treat people the way you'd like to be treated. We have built our interview process, not just in terms of what we want, but also what we think is reasonable for a candidate to do. So I'm really judicious. I run interview slates that are very, very tight. Like if these three people can't make a decision, or you know, or you can't make a decision in like 4 hours, like maybe we need to do something different. If you need to have a cultural aspect, like do it with multiple people, do a little bit of a board interview. One of the things I've seen work really, really well, we would put together a very simple test, like a coding test, which was an hour, take home, right? Do whatever you want. We just say, look, you've got 2 weeks to do it. And it was built and it was rigged with tests and everything. So it was very, very clear. And that was sort of a very simple filter, like, can they put something together that compiles? Which to this day, like, I'm still surprised by the number of people who frankly can't, who really need to be handheld to a point where it's surprising. And then once we do that, then I try and mimic a work environment. So we bring people in, and the first thing we do is they say, all right, let's actually work through a problem. We have this problem right now, and we're trying to figure out a design for this. Let's work through a design on a whiteboard with it, because that's the way you'd normally do it, right? You'd actually do it on a whiteboard, you sort of draw some lines and some arrows and think about all the different things that could go sideways. And then once that happens, we then take their code submission and they sit in front of a computer, and it's, you know, on a monitor, so that they're using it with the computer, right? They're not writing code on a whiteboard, which is amazing.
Yeah, never do that.
But then with the group, we say, all right, like, let's work through this. Like, what about this? Like, did you think about memory management here? Like, what? And then we sort of see how they respond, and not just how they respond, but also in what direction they go, right?
Yep.
One thing you have to remember, interviewing, when you are the interviewee, like the person being tested, like, it is stressful.
I know.
Give people leeway. Like, tell them, like, hey, man, like, it just feels like maybe you're kind of going around circles. You want to go outside and just get a coffee? Like, let's you and me just walk outside and go for a walk. Right. And it may cost you 5 minutes, but it's going to gain you 15 or 20 minutes on the other end. Totally worth it. And so that's the structure we did. Now, I've had some great interview processes where, you know, to me, it's what I think is, you know, undervalued is the person who's doing the organizing, right? This is where you need to be. This is what's going on. I'm being responsive. Like, oh, you need to reschedule. Don't worry. I got you. You know, I went to one interview where literally I had a chaperone the entire day. And yep. That person was making sure that, like, everything was on time, right? And everybody was also very clear about what they were supposed to ask me about. They all had a list. They're like, I've already read your resume. All we're going to do is talk. I already know what I'm supposed to focus on. I've already got feedback from the first few people. Like, it was structured. Yep.
How you do one thing is how you do everything. So it makes that candidate really want to work there when they have lots of choices of places to go.
Oh, yeah. That is. Yeah. And it's not that hard to do, right? Just takes a little bit of rigor.
It takes discipline. It takes discipline, yeah. Though, because hey, somebody in that chain might have called in sick. So the good chaperone will stitch it together where the applicant has no idea, right? I mean,
yeah,
there's a lot of nuance to it.
Yeah, don't set up a schedule and then have it. It's the same thing with one-on-ones, right? Don't reschedule the schedule halfway through because something happened that could be postponed. Like, don't do that. Like, that just happens too much. But it's funny. So on the horror story side, I've had this happen multiple times now, and I'm starting to wonder, like, what is up with it. I have had people show up with their own chaperone. One time it was, yeah, like, I've had people show up for interviews. One time they had a parent there with them. This person was in their late 20s, and their parent was there, and their parent was asking me questions at the end of this.
Whoa.
And to this day, I still have no idea how to handle this. I had the same thing happen where a recruiter kind of tried, you know, this is a recruiter I had worked with and trust. And he said, look, this guy, look, he's a little interesting, right? But he's a really, really good guy. I placed him once or twice. And everybody's been really, really happy with him, et cetera. But he kind of like managed the conversation a little bit during the introductions and everything else. And it wasn't until in the hindsight where I realized, because of his behavior once we hired him, why that was the case. And oh my gosh, like I've seen it 3 times now where someone has brought a chaperone, and it is incredible.
So while you're saying that, I could relate in that some of the highest, the best performing intelligent individuals I've had on teams were on the spectrum of sorts, right? They were high functioning in one direction or another on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And these folks, I'm serious, maybe 180 IQ type individuals. And even in terms of growth, I saw some of these folks gain some soft skills that were off the charts for them, for their own growth and so forth. And even some who had no filter. So they talked to me in ways that I learned about myself. I'm like, oh, dang, I do need to stop doing that, where nobody else had the cojones to tell me, you know? So I could see that. I've just never... And I'm only assuming, but I could see how that might be a situation. But what's kind of Well, I could see it both ways. I was going to say what's kind of harsh is that they're not, the chaperone's not going to be there when they're working. But I do understand, like you said, it's such a stressful situation that they also may be under considered. And really, there's someone you really want on your team. They're going to be the one patching Apache Spark and pushing that up to open source community or whatever it is. You know, like I've seen a lot of people, not a lot, I've seen a handful of really good individuals that fit into that equation, you know.
Yeah. But to be fair, I have hired plenty of people that didn't have strong, we'll just say didn't have strong social skills or the ability to really read a room and everything else. They, I have worked with plenty of them, have done fabulous things. I don't think that in these scenarios, that was really the case.
Okay. Interesting.
But it was just, to me, it was one of those things where, you know, you should kind of share like funny horror stories that you've experienced over time. And that's just one of them where to this day, I'm still like, why, like what happened and why? And that is just, yeah, I don't know.
So what I'd like to talk about next is maybe some of your stories working with recruiters. The theme here has been horror stories. Granted, there's some good experiences as well, but it seems that a lot of the CTOs I talk to have a lot of bad stories too. So maybe you could share some of those.
Yeah, definitely. I'll say this. One of the things I've figured out is I don't like to work with firms. I like working with individual recruiters, and whatever firm they go to, I will go to. I have probably similar horror stories to most. When we were growing at Rubicon, we were growing quickly. We enlisted a very popular brand name recruiting firm. Not sort of the national level that most people have heard of. It was Los Angeles, a big one in Los Angeles.
We'll call him Bobco. How about that?
Yes, Bobco. The two recruiters we're going to work with came in, and they were very, very nice. They'd obviously done their research, and they got going. And we got the first batch of resumes, and they were nowhere near what we were looking for. It's like they either mixed up their notes or they just weren't listening. We had a nice little call, got the second batch, got going. We finally got to a couple resumes after some iterations of people that we wanted. And so we have this one guy come in, and resume looked pretty good, which, and to be clear, I use resumes sort of as the first pass filter, right? I'm just trying to get rid of all the obvious people that just won't work. And I'm trying to focus on someone who, like, there's a diamond in the rough here, right? And so this one guy comes in and starts talking, and something just feels odd, like from the get-go. And he has all the right answers to all the questions. Like, so we ask him a bunch of technical questions. He breezes through them. We have asked him a bunch of questions about culture, which, relatively sound. We try and use the same measuring stick to measure everybody so that we have a basis for comparison. Answering them all, like, okay, this sounds weird. And then I said, actually, guys, we were doing a sort of a group interview towards the end. I said, actually, guys, would you guys give me just 15 or 20 minutes with this person by myself? And I started digging into some of the stuff he was saying, and I realized it was really just a veneer. There wasn't a whole lot of stuff behind it. And I said, look, you got to tell me, right? You've got all these answers, but I feel like as soon as we go deeper beyond the answers and I start doing weird things, that you go from being very, very confident and very, very aware to being sort of, a little bit tentative. And he says, I'll never forget this. He says, yeah, this has been a hard day. Like, what do you mean it's been a hard day? He's like, well, I spent most of this morning at the recruiting office, and they were basically training me and telling me all the things I needed to answer.
Right.
And it's just been a long day of just stuff, and I'm just getting tired. And I don't think he realized what he said, because then immediately he's like, I went over there, talked to them, blah, blah, blah. And so I called up the recruiter after, and I said, so, the guy just came in and told me. He's like, told me what? He's like, oh, told me that you have people come in first and give them all the answers. And he goes, oh, yeah, no, that's not at all what's going on. That's not happening, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, are you really going to tell me this with a straight face? He's like, look, we have people in. And then immediately starts walking back. And I'm just look, I can't believe this.
Yep, you're fired. I have a quick little one that I'll keep brief, but I was so mad when this happened. I wrote a blog post about it, which oddly people in this series bring up on their own without even knowing I wrote it. It's kind of funny, but
oh, really?
Yeah, I was like kind of floored because it happened twice within this week. People brought it up, and I'm like, I wrote that. But anyhow, it was because well, when we were at VideoAmp, I was not hiring juniors for a really long time for a really good reason, because we're, you know, 12 people doing RTB. You know, we're both in ad tech. We're doing, you know, 1.2 million requests per second and all kinds of crazy RTB stuff with like 12 or 15 engineers. So everybody had to be amazing. But as we grew, we had to bring in, and as we had the support structure for juniors, we brought them in. And so, you know, I was reluctantly starting to reach out to coding schools and stuff. And I even some of those folks we hired through coding schools are now our tech leads and stuff. They're that some of the cream of the crop, maybe one in 500, are just fantastic. But anyways, when I was going through the starting phases of hiring juniors, I started to interview coding school grads, or what I thought was happening. So it turned out they were doing bait and switch candidates with me, and they were doing these, I could tell because the ambient room noise wasn't just that somebody was sitting in a big room, like everybody in the room was listening to me. Like it was so that everybody else could hear how an interview goes down. And it was the teacher interviewing with me. And I didn't know, you know, that they weren't in the market. Then they suddenly decide to keep their job there. And here, why don't you, let me introduce you to this person over here who was not interviewed and not qualified. And it happened with two different orgs within a week, just by happenstance, because hey, I just opened up this process. So I was like, I was new to everybody.
Yep.
And I just got really ticked. I'm like, you know what? And I took it out. But actually, when I posted this to like LACTO forum and some other places, I got like so much pats on the back, like, oh my God, totally. Yeah. You know, people validated this from their own experience pretty quickly, because I guess my point of this article was just that people within the coding schools who didn't get a job would then become teachers, basically, or teacher's aides or whatever. And I was just questioning like the quality of what was coming out of that process. I don't want to diss on it, because I get it. Like there's some of the best people we ever hired did come from coding schools, and maybe they were a teacher beforehand, or a lot of lawyers actually do it. Cause I guess law and computing, software development is pretty similar, cause it's a very rules-based thing. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, anyways, I did a piece called Toddlers Are Raising Infants, and it just was a point in time for me where I almost wanted to retract it, but I got so much validation, I decided to leave it out there, you know. Bait and switch candidates, basically.
I was going to say, that takes a certain amount of brass to do, and I'm grateful that, that you're willing to expose the things, the dirty underbelly.
All right, so thank you very much for your time today, Peter. This has been a great discussion. I think we meandered through a lot of great topics, and I definitely took away some good pieces of advice and knowledge. So thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you very much. And thank you not just for the time, but also for putting all this out there for the next generation of engineers that need some help as they grow.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.